Should we rejoice when criminals are brought to justice? Welcome again to The Good Word. I'm Brant Berglund, our author of the study guide and host this quarter, and my conversation partners again are Alden Thompson and Dave Thomas, and we're working our way through the book of Revelation, and in chapter 17 and 18, we see the antithesis of God personified as a city and a woman and a beast. Babylon the Great is her name, and we see the fall of Babylon. Before we see the fall of Babylon in chapter 18, though, John is whisked away in vision to see this woman, and we'll take a look at her more in just a moment. What do you think? Should we rejoice when criminals are brought to justice? Is there a sense in which atoning for wrong is good, but is there also hope of redemption? What do you think?
I much prefer when a prisoner is redeemed and restored to rightful living. You know, I'm not sure what justice is. You know, if you stole a sheep and had to give it back, if it hasn't changed you and made you into a better citizen, we've only restored a sheep. We haven't fixed the problem because you're going to take another sheep somewhere else.
What do you think, Alden? Do you concur with
that?
Well,
I was just thinking here. I had an old college friend who worked in the New York penal system. In fact, he was a physician for the whole state in their penal system. And he pointed out that the best method of recidivism,
I mean combating recidivism?
Yeah, is education, you know.
Helping them study,
get a degree,
do something with themselves.
And I think, Dave, ultimately we need to look at the restorative way instead of the recrimination way. But, of course, this is a pretty brutal description here when you consider what the beast and the evil woman have done. It's understandable that there could be some rejoicing that God's heaven is now clean. Let's rejoice.
Yeah, and I don't think anybody truly rejoices when they see people, even those who have done wrong, suffering. But in this case, we seem to be talking about more than just individuals as well. We're talking about entire philosophies and ideologies that have been opposed to God. Chapter 17 opens with John being whisked away to see the judgment of the great harlot who sits on many waters. And so he is told that he's going to see a harlot. And then he is taken in the spirit to the wilderness, and there he sees a woman sitting on a scarlet beast, full of blasphemous names, having 7 heads and 10 horns. The last time we saw a woman and a scarlet beast with 7 heads and 10 horns, the beast was chasing a woman, and she was beautiful.
And she running away into the wilderness.
She was running away into the wilderness, and the dragon went after her. What's happened? What is the imagery here suggesting?
Well, the dragon apparently has not destroyed her by eating her. No.
No, that it's...
But she has been transformed. If it's the same woman, she has been radically transformed to be the very opposite of what she was.
Yeah, and now it says that she's riding the beast. They have some kind of relationship. She's using the beast in his power.
Yeah.
This is a frightening picture because if this is the church... It shows what happens, again, and I know we've talked about it this quarter previously, but when religious ideology or any type of ideology gets state power, it gets some kind of secular authority with the power of the state behind it, it will persecute.
Now, you're operating from the long tried and true idea that the beasts in these apocalyptic sections represent different powers.
Yes, not an individual, certainly.
No.
But I would say that it can happen to individuals as well.
Yeah.
What happens if... We see this happen with young people who perhaps start out with a wonderful singing career. They become super famous by the time they're in their early 20s, and all the power goes to their head.
Or you can look at political rulers who do that, see?
Certainly.
But what you're pointing at here, Branto, is quite astonishing, so that if in Revelation 12... The what's sometimes called the pure woman represents the church in its pristine state. What does this harlot or prostitute represents the church in an apostate state? Is that what we're saying here?
It seems to be. It also says that she has committed adultery with the kings of the earth. In other words, it describes their relationship as an illicit one. It uses the language of illicit sexuality, which throughout the Old Testament, that was the language that God used of Israel. Whenever Israel, his bride, his people, would run off and go get Egypt or Assyria to be their partner, their ally, God says, "You've abandoned me. Aren't I your husband?" And he called them over and over a prostitute, a harlot, right?
Yeah.
Maybe that's the imagery here, that his church, is it possible for the church of God to become corrupt by making power the source of its
position?
Well,
that's happened too many times not to be able to answer the question.
Yeah.
Well, in Adventist history, perhaps the most interesting time was the 1890s. That was a time when Adventists shipped Ellen White over to Australia to get her out of their hair. But as she wrote back, observing what was happening in the church, she actually made the explicit comparison of the church like Rome.
Mm.
Come to the very gates of Rome. So the potential for power, misuse of power, the abuse of power is there in the church. And we certainly ought to pray that the Lord will preserve the church from that deviation.
And certainly the believing community in the Old Testament went through cycles of infidelity toward God. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, you read the Hebrew prophets, and they're pretty vocal about that. The most astonishing one to me is in the time of, I think it was Josiah, when they cleaned out the temple, they discovered a copy of the Law of the Covenant, and they were surprised to read it. Nobody knew what it said, which to me is amazing. How could they have departed from their own history to the point where they didn't know what originated their history?
And what's particularly interesting there, Dave, is that Hezekiah had a great reform 80 years before.
Oh, yeah, but
so two generations.
So between the time of Hezekiah and Josiah, the law had gotten lost.
And did they have the law in Hezekiah's day, though? Or was it lost there? It's just that he brought about a partial reform.
Well, the law scroll doesn't play the same role
in
Hezekiah as it does in Josiah's reform.
But, I mean, that represents quite a departure by the believing community. And apparently here in Revelation, you have the New Testament counterpart of that same kind of dynamic.
And once again, and we've talked about history repeating itself or basically the same concepts occurring again and again. Why is it that we have to relive history? Why can't we just learn the lessons of the past? And
well, I have an answer for you, Brent. I think that the hardest thing for a human being to maintain is dependence on God. Because I would like to run my own life, thank you very much, and you would like to run yours. And to live in a yielded frame of mind is very difficult for humans. And especially if we become powerful, if we somehow can persuade ourselves that we're now self-sufficient, then God doesn't just become redundant, he becomes problematic. Mm-hmm. Because of all beings you can imagine, God is most capable or by default will be most probable he'll be the one who most probably interferes with your personal autonomy, see.
But there are ways in which one can simply co-opt God. I think of that sobering passage in Matthew where Jesus, in response to James and John who asked for the top places in the kingdom, he says, "You know that the rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their great ones exercise authority over them. It will not be so among you. Whoever would be great among you must be your servant. Whoever would be
first." But that's the statement of the ideal, Alden. It's not what happens in actuality, right?
That's true. But it's one, I think, once upon a time, the dean of the school of theology said that passage is so important that every preacher ought to repeat it every day.
I would say that every person who has power should repeat that, every church power, not just a preacher.
And because of the themes in Revelation of the abuses of power, here we have then the woman who was beautiful, I think, in chapter 12, has now become altered by power, and she has this illicit
made an alliance with the nations of earth.
Exactly. So then I have to ask, is it possible that I am exempt, or my church is exempt, my denomination or my faith? Is it possible that the country in which I live, the United States, or even a global community, is exempt from this happening because we're now beyond this?
Let him that standeth take heed lest he fall.
Yeah. You agree, Dave?
Yeah, I do. I mean, it's an astonishing thing. This has happened so many times in history that I despair of us learning any lessons from history. You know, that somehow when people become powerful, they find a way of justifying their behavior and creating rationales that excuse them from the passage Alden quoted a minute ago. Well, that's true, but we're not doing that. We're not the ones who are, you know, that doesn't really apply to us.
I've been entrusted power to do good with it. I will do better than others.
I'm not really lording it over anybody. I'm merely preserving the church for the people of God. You know?
These are certainly challenges, but what the book of Revelation portrays is that this is the precursor to Babylon's fall. Babylon has this illicit affair. She is drunk on the blood of the saints with the kings of the earth, and then Babylon, the people that she is allied with, the kings of the earth, actually turn on Babylon, and the language here is very abusive. It's very violent. It says they strip her naked, and they burn her with fire. The language of the burning of fire takes us back to the Old Testament penalty for the execution of the daughter of a priest. If a daughter of a priest has an affair, she could be burned to death. And here then, what does that suggest about this woman? This was none other than perhaps the daughter of the high priest of Israel, right? Of perhaps Jesus Christ himself, and now she is being burned with fire, right? This, or at least that's potentially some of the language. Chapter 18 talks about Babylon's fall, and it recalls many of the Old Testament chapters from Isaiah, perhaps Isaiah 47, Jeremiah 50 to 52, passages in Ezekiel, all these different pictures of Babylon, and even it includes some of the language of the fall of Egypt. It's not just the language of Babylon in the Old Testament, but at the conclusion of chapter 18, we see the saints of God, heaven and earth, it says in verse 20, rejoice over her, O heaven, and you saints and apostles and prophets, because God has pronounced judgment for you against her. Is it okay to have this kind of rejoicing, even over the fall of Babylon?
Well, I think it's unavoidable and uncontainable. And I don't think it's glee or delight at destruction. It's rejoicing in the fact that the war is over or the arch enemy is finished.
Well, there is a human impulse. When the bully finally gets his comeuppance, you know, it's very difficult to restrain.
Some celebration.
And I root for the underdog in a football game far too often, and when the underdog wins, the rejoicing is great.
That's right.
Yeah. Well, we've come to the end of our time here for chapter 17 and 18. I encourage you to go back and read through those chapters yourself. And don't forget to download the study guide from our website. I want to say thanks again to Alden and Dave for your insights and comments today. Thanks again for our sound engineer work with Jared Miller. He's so consistent in helping with that. And for those of you who are listening to The Good Word, thank you as well. I'm Brant Berglund.
You've been listening to Good Word, a production of the School of Theology at Walla Walla University and KGTS-FM. To order a copy of today's broadcast, you can call 509-527-2194. Thanks for listening, and we'll be here next week at this time with Good Word.